That's what this woman is talking about and says it with no shame.
What should President Trump do on day one when he gets back in?
Lock him up,
right? The deep state, take it down?
Take him to train station.
Take him to train station? I didn't say that.
That's even almost too much for Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend, Brian Glenn, who does these interviews. This is what Nazis say. Here's a guy at the Trump rally who told Brian Glenn, Trump's trying to expose the deep state. And Lindsey Graham's part of that deep state.
I'm sure.
But first, you got to expose the deep state.
Okay, well,
and he's been working on that.
Working on it.
One of the creatures is here, Lindsey Graham.
There you go. Brian Glenn also unsure whether he wants to get involved in that. Of course, one of the things cultists often say when they are constantly lied to by the cult leader is that the cult leader is really honest. Here's what this woman had to say.
Like, people are becoming more involved rather than they did before. And a lot of people's eyes are opening to what is more truthful and what's not.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Truth is a revolution right now. And that's not something that we've had in a long time.
It feels good. It's refreshing to think.
Yeah. It's refreshing that Trump is so honest. So honest. And then even interviewing an 11-year-old girl who has been sadly brainwashed with the same stuff, says Trump's the only honest guy left.
Why are you excited to be here? What made you want to come out?
Because I love Trump.
What is it that you like about Donald Trump?
He only tells the truth.
Oh, that's a big thing, right? Telling the truth.
Scary cult stuff. Scary cult stuff. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Remember, Alex Jones hates the bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Howard Stern likes the bonus show, but he won't pay for it.
A David Pacman membership costs $6 a month.
Yeah. Joinpacman.com, my friends. That's the place to sign up. We will see you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
With your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It was like a classic kidnap, like the ones they used to do. It just hasn't happened in a long time. They came, threw the taxi driver out of the car. They got in, put my head down and tied my hands. They put me on my knees and a pistol to my head.
Prominent Russian journalist Elena Melashina suffers brain injury after being violently attacked while reporting in Chechnya. We'll go to Moscow. But first to Kyiv, as Ukrainians mourn the death of writer Victoria Amelina. She was killed in a Russian airstrike in Kramatorsk. We'll speak with her friend Andrei Kirkov, one of Ukraine's best-known authors. He says her smile sparkled even in the most difficult times. Then to Syria, where the United Nations has established an independent body to investigate what happened to more than 130,000 people who've gone missing during the 12-year conflict. We'll also look at a new BBC documentary, Captagon, inside Syria's drug trafficking empire.
My search reveals the role of Syria's most powerful family.
No smuggler operates without connections to the regime.
And I uncover how the Syrian regime itself has become addicted to Captagon.
If Assad stopped the drug trade for 20 days, the economy would collapse.
And here in the United States, we'll speak with Congressmember Ro Khanna. He's introduced a bill to limit Supreme Court justices to 18-year terms. He was also the only member of the House Armed Services Committee to vote no on the new Pentagon budget. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Atomic Energy Agency says it's seen no evidence to back claims by Ukraine's government that Russia's military has planted explosives at the Russian-held Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant in southern Ukraine. But the IAEA said it needs additional access to all six of Zaporizhzhia's reactor buildings to be sure. Both Moscow and Kyiv have accused each other of preparing to sabotage Europe's biggest nuclear plant. Overnight, a Russian missile attack on the western city of Lviv killed at least four people and injured 32 others. In eastern Ukraine, an airstrike triggered a massive fireball in the Russian-occupied city of Makivka. Russian officials said the strike hit a hospital, killing one person, injuring dozens. Ukraine's military says the video clearly shows it struck a Russian arms depot. In Minsk, Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said earlier today the head of Russia's Wagner Group is not in Belarus and is instead in St. Petersburg, Russia. His surprise announcement came after Russian state TV broadcast images of police raids on Yevgeny Prigozhin's office in St. Petersburg in one of his mansions. Prigozhin has not been seen publicly since June 24th. President Lukashenko previously claimed Prigozhin had arrived in Belarus to live in exile as part of agreement that ended a mutiny by Wagner forces as they advanced to within 120 miles of Moscow. President Biden met with Swedish Prime Minister at the White House Wednesday, ahead of NATO's annual summit in Vilnius, Lithuania, next week.
Sweden is going to make our alliance stronger and has the same value set that we have in NATO. And really looking, anxiously looking forward for your membership.
Sweden's bid to join NATO has been blocked by the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who accuses Sweden of harboring members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is considered a terrorist group by Turkey. Turkey's opposition to Sweden joining NATO is now facing a further challenge as protests have broken out in a number of Muslim countries after two men staged a demonstration in which they tore up and burned a Quran outside a Stockholm mosque last week. This is an Iranian protester speaking Monday in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran.
We declare that we are Muslims, and no country has the right to insult the Quran and cannot desecrate the Quran. And if they insult it, they will be given a strong response.
Pope Francis has also condemned the Quran burning. A federal judge in Louisiana has barred Biden administration officials from asking social media companies to remove misinformation from websites and apps. The ruling has broad ramifications for the ability of government officials to engage with the public through popular online forums. In a 155-page ruling handed down Tuesday, U.S. District Court Judge Terry Doty, a Trump appointee, issued an injunction against federal officials and agencies contacting sites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, siding with Republican attorneys general who accused President Biden of trying to silence his critics. Judge Doty said several federal officials violated the First Amendment when they asked social media companies to take down misinformation about COVID-19, including false content about vaccines and the effectiveness of wearing masks. The judge also accused officials of suppressing free speech by battling claims that the 2020 presidential election was rigged. Legal observers say the sweeping ruling could end up enjoining hundreds of thousands of government employees from participating in online debate. In more technology news, Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, has officially launched a rival social media platform to Twitter, which has been struggling to retain users and advertisers since its purchase by billionaire Elon Musk last October. In the latest in a series of unpopular moves, Musk said over the weekend Twitter will begin limiting the number of tweets its users would be able to view per day unless they pay for premium service. Meanwhile, Canada's government says it's halted all advertising on Facebook and Instagram after Meta moved to restrict news content across Canada. Meta's move came after Canadian lawmakers approved the Online News Act, which will require tech companies to pay news outlets for posting their content on their platforms. Google's parent company, Alphabet, has also removed Canadian news articles from search results after calling the new law unworkable. President Biden has nominated Elliot Abrams to the bipartisan U.S. Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy. Elliot Abrams was convicted in 1991 of lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair and later pardoned by then-President George H.W. Bush. He defended death squads in Guatemala and El Salvador in the 1980s as when he was serving as Assistant Secretary of State under President Ronald Reagan. Abrams dismissed reports that El Salvador's U.S.-trained military had massacred 1,000 civilians, including children, in the Salvadoran town of El Mazote in December 1981. He's also been linked to the 2002 attempted coup against Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and helped plan the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Under President Trump, Abrams served as special envoy to Iran and Venezuela. Abrams will need to be confirmed by the Senate to serve on the commission. The United Nations is warning rates of severe malnutrition in Ethiopia's Tigray have risen sharply, with nearly 9 million people needing food aid in the war-ravaged northern region. The World Food Program and the U.S. government, Ethiopia's two largest food donors, both halted deliveries to Tigray in April, saying the food was being diverted away from those in need. A Tigrayan official said hundreds have died, including children, since the aid was withdrawn, calling the situation extremely desperate. In Israel, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of Tel Aviv Wednesday evening after the city's police commander announced he's resigning under pressure from senior Israeli government officials. Commander Ami Eshed said he would rather step aside than follow the demands of cabinet members who demanded a violent crackdown on protesters opposed to plans by the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu to gut Israel's judiciary. This is a protester speaking Wednesday.
I'm here today because I'm an Israeli who cares about democracy. I know that if the government decided to fire the head police officer of Tel Aviv only because he decided that it's legal to protest, I think this is one step further for Israel to be a non-democratic state.
There were no mass protests in Israel over this week's two-day raid in Jenin, which killed 12 Palestinians, including four children, displaced thousands of residents and razed homes to the ground. Back in the United States, unionized UPS drivers and warehouse workers are moving closer to a strike after contract negotiations broke down Wednesday. More than 340,000 UPS workers represented by the Teamsters are fighting for better wages and soaring cost of living increases in company profits. The current contract expires July 31st. In more labor news, thousands of Los Angeles hotel workers returned to work Wednesday after a three-day strike over the busy July 4th weekend. Workers say more stoppages are to be expected until a deal is reached on fair wages, health care and pension benefits, and improved working conditions. And in a major victory for baristas, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Starbucks violated federal labor law when it fired workers at several Pittsburgh stores who were organizing their co-workers. Starbucks now has over 330 unionized coffee shops. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Ukraine. Overnight, a Russian missile strike hit a residential building in the western city of Lviv, killing four, injuring 32 others. Meanwhile, in eastern Ukraine, an airstrike triggered a massive fireball in the Russian-occupied city of Makivka. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed there would be a, quote, tangible response. This comes as Ukrainians gathered Tuesday to mourn the death of renowned writer Victoria Amelina. She died as a result of injuries from a Russian strike on a restaurant in Kramatorsk last week, which killed 13 people. Amelina was part of a human rights group, Truth Hounds, investigating Russian war crimes. She had been meeting with a group of Colombians at a restaurant in Kramatorsk when she died. She was remembered by her peers during a funeral service in Kyiv.
It was important to her to travel to the deoccupied areas and gather testimonies about Russia's crimes and tell the world about it as much as she can. We did not only lose a writer and poet in her prime, but also a human rights defender, an honest and shining voice on the international stage.
For more, we're joined by Andrei Kirkov, one of Ukraine's best-known authors, former president of PEN Ukraine. He was a friend of Victoria Amelina. His tribute to her in The Guardian is headlined, "Her smile sparkled even in the most difficult times." Andrei is the author of dozens of books, most recently Diary of an Invasion. Welcome back to Democracy Now! And our deepest condolences to you, Andrei Kirkov. She was not only a well-known writer, but a friend of yours. Can you tell us about Victoria Amelina, how she lived and then how she died?
Well, she was a normal person. She actually looked very shy when if you just saw her in the street. She was a nice, always smiling and shyly smiling person who changed her, I would say, way of life several times because when she was 14, she was taken by her father to Canada to immigration. And later, several years later, she decided to go back to Ukraine, to her favorite and her own city of Lviv, where she studied computer sciences and she became a very good programmer. And then she decided to quit the job and to become a writer. And she was writing poems, essays, and she published two novels. But from 2014-15, after the Euromaidan, she became very politically engaged, very socially engaged. She became a member of PEN Ukraine. She immediately started organizing campaigns to free Alexei Nsov from Russian prison. I am talking about a film director and writer from Crimea who was accused by Russians of terrorist activities, which was a false accusation, of course, who spent 5 years in a Russian prison. And since then, she was actually more, I think, active politically and socially than literally, because she was, just didn't have enough time to write. And also when she was wounded in Kramatorsk, she was there together with our colleagues from Latin America from representatives of the pro-Ukrainian movement Aguanta Ukraina, Resist Ukraine. And also, I mean, she died on the 1st of July, which is the birthday of another writer, Vladimir Vakulenko, who was killed 1 year ago by Russian military, and whose body she was looking for several months before his body was identified in November in the mass grave near Kharkiv region city of Izum. And she recovered his last diaries that he hid under the tree, under the cherry tree of his parents' garden. Actually, several days before she was wounded, on 22nd of June, she was presenting the book, posthumous book of Volodymyr Vakulenko, where these diaries were included. So she was one of the most active Ukrainian authors and I would say political and literary activists, yeah.
Andrei, could you talk about, you've said, I mean, she was working on, since the invasion, documenting war crimes in Ukraine. Yeah. If you could say, she was working on her first nonfiction book in English about war crimes being documented by Ukrainian women. The book was to be titled War and Justice Diary, Looking at Women, Looking at War. Could you talk about that?
Well, this book was almost finished. I think it's like 80% of the book she wrote. She wrote it in English so that it would become easier accessible to the publishers abroad. Last 16 months, she was traveling all the time either to the front lines, to the recently liberated Ukrainian territories, and then immediately to the States, to Europe, to report on the atrocities committed by the Russian army. And all this was for the sake of the book, which will be published, I believe. I don't know yet the name of the publisher, but this was her last project, and it will remain her last project.
Andrei, could you talk about, I mean, she is one of dozens of writers who have been killed, writers, filmmakers who've been killed since the war began. Could you talk about some of the others who've died in these months, over a year, since the Russian invasion?
Well, we have about 30, or maybe probably already more, artistic personalities who became victims of this war, victims of Russian army shellings, or who were killed on the front lines as soldiers. I mentioned already Volodymyr Vakulenko, who was author of books for children, who decided to not to evacuate from his village Kapitolivka in the eastern Ukraine because of his severely disabled son, and who was first taken for questioning in the beginning of March, and then returned home. And second time he was taken for questioning, and he was never seen again. And he was finally buried in December last year. He's remembered as one of the most sort of tragic victims of this war. I can mention, of course, many others, including Yuri Ruf, who was killed in action. Also a poet from Lviv who volunteered to become a soldier and who was fighting in eastern Ukraine. But, I mean, probably we will have a separate book with texts written by authors killed by the Russian aggression published in the nearest future. I mean, we don't know when the war is going to end, but it will cost a lot for Ukrainian culture. obviously.
Andrei Kirchhoff, we talked to you just over a year ago. You were here in New York with a big Penn event. You were talking about your book, Gray Bees, which is known all over. You've written a new book now. It's called A Diary of an Invasion. Explain how you started writing it. You went back to Ukraine after we spoke, and you just came back to Kyiv as well. You were out of the country. Explain the situation for you as a writer in Ukraine now.
Well, I do write diaries, but I was writing mostly articles and essays about what was happening from the very beginning of the war and also before the new invasion. And I was asked by my English publisher, Christopher McLaughlin, to send him the texts, which I did. And in the end, the book was published first in London in October last year. It covers the events in Ukraine from December 21 till July 22. And it includes also not only my diary notes, but also articles and essays that I wrote for international media and published in the newspapers like The Guardian, The Financial Times, or in the magazines like The New Statesman and Spectator. Actually, I continue to write essays about what is happening now, and probably they will be included in the second volume of the diaries.
Andrei Kirchhoff, again, our condolences on the death of your friend and a friend to so many, the Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina. Andrei Kirchhoff, one of Ukraine's best-known authors, former president of Penn Ukraine. His tribute to her in The Guardian will link to her smile sparkled even in the most difficult times. Andrei is the author of dozens of books, including Gray Bees, his most recent Diary of an Invasion. We're going now from Kyiv to Moscow to look at how the prominent Russian journalist, Elena Milashina, has been diagnosed with a brain injury and multiple fractures after she was violently attacked July 4th, along with attorney Alexander Nemov, while on their way to the court sentencing of a human rights activist in Grozny, Chechnya's capital. Unknown assailants beat them, shaved off Elena's hair, doused her in blue-green liquid iodine. Her fingers were reportedly broken because she resisted demands to unlock her phone. Elena Milashina reports for Novaya Gazeta, exposing human rights abuses in Chechnya. She described the harrowing attack from the hospital where she was being treated.
It was like a classic kidnap, like the ones they used to do. It just hasn't happened in a long time. They came, threw the taxi driver out of the car. They got in, put my head down and tied my hands. They put me on my knees and a pistol to my head.
Elena Milashina works for the newspaper Novaya Gazeta, one of the last independent media outlets in Russia, co-founded by the Nobel Peace Laureate Dmitry Muratov, stripped of its media license last year. For more, we go to Moscow to speak with Anna Dubrovskaya. She served as the executive director of Memorial Human Rights Center in Moscow before it was shut down by the Russian government last year. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Under very sad circumstances, as we report on the death of the Ukrainian writer Victoria Amelina, and now the savage attack on Elena Milashina in Chechnya. Can you talk about the circumstances, what you understand? We had her in our studio years ago talking about the gravity of the situation in Chechnya. Now it's different, but she's still been brutalized.
Hello, Amy. Thank you for having me back. Yes, Elena Milashina, as you said, is one of the bravest Russian journalists who worked a lot covering the human rights violations in Chechnya. And she was indeed on her way to a court hearing in Grozny, but it was not a human rights activist. It was actually a mother of three human rights and oppositional activists, Yangubayev brothers, who all of them are outside of Russia at the moment, but their mother was taken as a hostage. And on the day of attack against Elena and Alexander, Zarema Musayeva, it's her name, she was sentenced to five and a half years in prison for the falsified case of fraud. This is unfortunately one of the multiple cases when human rights activists are being abused and suppressed, so they would either leave the region and leave the country or stop talking altogether. And this is done, so her sons would return back to Russia, and if they do this, they immediately will be taken by Chechen authorities, and we can most surely say that they will be tortured to death or killed right away. So Yelena Milashina from Novaya Gazeta, together with Alexander Nemov, who is a lawyer from Committee Against Torture, attorney at law, they were on their way to be at the court hearing. And as Yelena described, they were very brutally attacked. It was not the first attack against Yelena in Chechnya. The last time she was attacked about two years ago. It was also in Grozny, also on her way to one of the human rights trial. And she is probably one of the few persons who always comes back. I cannot say I wish she comes back to Chechnya after what happened, because it's a very clear signal that next time it will be even more brutal than that.
Anna, she was actually, in addition, of course, to having been attacked before, Kadyrov, the head of the Chechen Republic, openly threatened her in 2022, last year, calling her a terrorist and terrorist accomplice and demanding her arrest. So could you talk about that? And therefore, given his open comments, public comments about her, it was quite extraordinary that she went, because she must have known that she would once again be targeted.
It's both predictable and unpredictable when exactly you will be targeted if you go to Chechnya. There is a saying that whoever tells you that it is difficult to work in Chechnya, do not believe them, because it's impossible to work there. And of course, Yelena knew this very well, but still she made this choice to go and to demonstrate that she is not afraid, that human rights lawyers are not afraid of going, that attorneys are not afraid to go there, though it is becoming more and more dangerous. Yes, Kadyrov openly, publicly said this speech terrorizing her and blaming her as a terrorist and saying that there will be some consequences. And I think there was a criminal case open because of this speech, but these cases never go anywhere. And right now, the criminal case was also open because of this attack, because of attack on Yelena and Alexander. And somehow the reaction of like federal authorities is very, very unique. They are saying that this is absolutely impossible. This has to be investigated. But at the same time, Chechen authorities says that none of that was recorded on the security cameras. We don't know who those people were. We just basically know nothing about them, but we will keep looking. So it's like a very common response by the Chechen authorities, and actually almost all the other authorities in Russia. Whenever a human rights defender, a journalist, and an independent lawyer is being attacked, it's more or less always the same response. And we still don't know who killed Natalia Estimirova, and we still have no clear picture on the killing of Anna Politkovskaya. So unfortunately, it's continuing to go this way.
Anna, wasn't Elena also covering the situation for the LGBT community in Chechnya?
It was the coverage, yes, of situation with LGBT community, but more important than that, it was she was covering the location and existence of the secret prisons in Chechnya. And it's not solemnly targeting the LGBT community, mostly men, but it was targeting basically every— it's not activists, but every person who would speak openly something against Kadyrov's regime. Basically, no one could have been could have feel saved in Chechnya if he or she wanted to say something against. But at some point, a particular wave of repression was targeted LGBT men, gay men, and unfortunately, yeah, there was a wave of that. We don't know what is happening with that now, because the region is extremely closed. Memorial was evicted from Chechnya in 2018 after our colleague Oyub was also imprisoned under falsified case. And since that time, it's only very random visits of human rights defenders And unfortunately, they continue to be attacked there.
And while you were head of Memorial Human Rights Center, as you said, you worked on documenting war crimes in Chechnya. If you could talk about the period you covered and also explain Kadyrov's rise to power. His father had fought against the Russians in the first Chechen war, but then changed sides in the second Chechen war. So could you explain the position he now occupies, how he came to occupy that position, and his relationship to Putin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chechnya is a very particular part of Russia. It's a beautiful region with a very tragic episodes of history. It was one of the strongest separatist movement after Russia became independent from the Soviet Union, and people were bravely struggling to gain more independence or to gain, you know, more fair negotiations about their status with the federal authorities. Unfortunately or fortunately, they didn't succeed, like it didn't happen. But then there was a second Chechen war, and between those wars and during them as well, there were massive terrorist attacks in the region of Northern Caucasus and also in like, you know, central cities of Russia. Some investigators say that those attacks have been performed by FSB, actually to blame it on terrorists from Northern Caucasus. But unfortunately, right now, we don't have any evidence to say if it was one or the other. And it was used, I think that Putin's regime and Yeltsin regime, they negotiated some kind of deal with Ahmad Kadyrov, with the father of Ramzan, saying that you will have complete power over this region. If you stop fighting for freedom, we will give you whatever you want. And then you can just, like, you will be the king of this land. And that's what have happened. And his father was killed by the terrorist attack in Grozny on the stadium many, many years ago. And then the authorities came to Ramzan, who was quite young at the moment. And now he basically rules a very, very harsh dictatorship in the region. Memorial always said that whatever is happening in Chechnya, it does not get any investigation or any proper response from the authorities. And thus, this wave of impunity was growing first in Russia. And then, as we can see, it started also falling on Ukraine, on other countries. And unfortunately, it demonstrates to us again, once we ignore human rights violations that are happening inside the dictatorship like Russia, it will always, always, always end up in a massive, horrible massacres outside its borders.
Anna Dobrovolskaya, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Served as executive director of Memorial Human Rights Center in Moscow before it was shut down by the Russian government last year. Next up, we go to Syria, where the United Nations has established an independent body to investigate what happened to more than 130,000 people who've gone missing during the 12-year conflict. And we'll look at a new BBC documentary, Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire. Then Congressmember Ro Khanna joins us from South Carolina. Stay with us. ساقی غم فردای حریفان چه خوری پیش آر پیاله را که شب می گذارد پیش آر پیاله را که شب می گذارد Caravan of Life by Massa Fatah. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we turn to Syria. Humanitarian groups Wednesday urged the United Nations Security Council to extend Syria's cross-border aid mechanism for another year in order to ensure the delivery of humanitarian aid to more than 4 million people in northwest Syria after 12 years of war. The mechanism was established in 2014 to enable the UN and other humanitarian groups to provide aid to opposition-held areas in Syria without the authorization
authorization of the Syrian government. Doctors Without Borders reports the number of authorized crossing points is now down from 4 to 1, even after an earthquake devastated parts of Syria in February, and the need is enormous. Meanwhile, the United Nations General Assembly has approved a resolution to establish an independent body to investigate what happened to more than 130,000 people who've gone missing during the conflict in Syria, and to, quote, provide adequate support to victims, survivors, and the families of those missing. The Syrian government, opposed the resolution along with Russia, China, Belarus, North Korea, Cuba, and Iran. This comes as ITV News reports that in the days leading up to the failed mutiny by Wagner Group in Russia, Syrian officials were in talks to increase the number of Wagner fighters in Syria and make Syria its biggest base as part of a lucrative deal with President Bashar al-Assad. In a minute, we're going to look at a new BBC documentary investigating Assad's role in producing the highly addictive amphetamine known as Captagon and how this is impacting his relations with Saudi Arabia and other countries. But we begin with Dr. Zahar Salul, president and CEO of the medical nonprofit Med Global, which provides health care in disaster regions, including Syria. He was also a classmate of Bashar al-Assad in medical school. Yes, the president of Syria is also a doctor. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Dr. Zahar Salul. Start off with talking about the 120,000 people it's estimated are missing in the 12 years of this conflict, doctor.
Thank you, Amy, for having me. And this is one of the most painful chapters in the Syrian crisis. As you mentioned, 120,000 people are at least missing in the last 12 years. Most of them, according to human rights organizations by the Assad regime, about 85% of them. One of them is a dentist and also the chess champion in Syria. Her name is Dr. Rania Abbasi, who disappeared in 2013 by the Assad regime intelligence in the prison with her 6 children. One of them was 1.5, 1 year and a half. And the oldest was 13 years old. She still disappeared, and no one knows where she. But she's one of tens of thousands of women and children and men who disappeared by the Assad regime, and their families do not know any information about them. Some of the family members got to know that their loved ones have died under torture by looking at the pictures of the Caesar files, which, as you remember, this is a person who smuggled about 30,000 pictures of people who died under torture by the Assad regime, and some family members discovered that their loved ones died because of torture. So hopefully this will allow the families of the loved ones who their loved ones, sons, children, sisters, and fathers have disappeared, to have one source of information about their family members, and hopefully have a closure for this painful chapter.
Dr. Salul, how is this mechanism, this institution, likely to work? What tools will people have to find these disappeared people? I suppose the assumption is they're either in the prison system or have been killed.
When I was young, growing in Syria, my uncle, who was in high school, also was forcefully disappeared, or actually he was detained by the father, the father of current president, Hafez al-Assad. And I remember my grandmother's going every week to the local authorities, the intelligence authorities, trying to find some information about him. And every week she comes back humiliated and not knowing what's going on with him. He stayed in the Palmyra prison for 12 years, and then suddenly he appeared. So many of the family members do not know any information about their loved ones. They go from place to place. They contact human rights organizations, different ones. So this new entity hopefully will allow more coordinations between the different human rights organizations that collect information about the families and the victims. It should have representations of the victims, the survivors of torture, and also the families, so their voice can be heard. And so that way you have one stop for everyone who lost someone, who has someone disappeared in the prisons of Assad, and also other entities who are in Syria. You have also opposition groups and the SDF who also detained and forcefully disappeared other victims.
Abdul, could you talk about, you've gone to Syria multiple times to assist in providing medical assistance. You were there just earlier this year after the earthquake. Could you describe the conditions in Syria now? Reportedly, 90%, up to 90% of Syrians are now living in poverty.
It's devastating. It's painful for me because I grew up in Syria and then came to the United States and practicing a physician. Every time I go there and I see the deterioration of the condition and the level of this, you know, disparity and also the number of displaced people, I was inside Idlib, northwest of Syria, providing some training on new technology that helps physicians to treat trauma patients. But I was in the middle of large IDP camp that has 500,000 people. Everywhere you see around, you see tents. There is 1.5 million people who live in tents in Idlib. Half of the population, 4 million that you mentioned in your report, are displaced from cities like Homs and Damascus and Aleppo. And they cannot imagine going back to their cities with the Assad regime still in control. And the economic situation is horrible. The children are everywhere. You look in the camp, but there's no enough schooling. Education is one of the most hit sectors in the economy there, and many parts of Syria. Also, healthcare is one of the worst hit. According to the WHO, half of the hospitals have been attacked by the Assad regime and by Russia. You mentioned in your previous piece about the Russian attacks on Chechnya. We believe in Syria that because what happens in Syria, you have now the war in Ukraine. There is a direct link between what happened in Syria, where the Russians used illegal weapons, they trained their army, they used, according to them, 300 new weapons in Syria. They targeted hospitals and civilian buildings like what they did today in Lviv, and now they're doing it in Ukraine because the war did not pay attention to what they were doing in Syria.
We're turning now to a new investigation by the BBC that reveals direct links between Syria's trade and the highly addictive amphetamine drug called Captagon and members of the armed forces and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's family.
My search reveals the role of Syria's most powerful family.
No smuggler operates without connections to the regime.
And I uncover how the Syrian regime itself has become addicted to Captagon.
If Assad stopped the drug trade for 20 days, the economy would collapse.
That's the opening of the new BBC documentary Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire. The reporter narrating the piece is Rasha Kandil, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a presenter for BBC Arabic. She's going to join us in a minute from Cairo. But first, another clip where she speaks with a Syrian soldier who reveals his role in the Captagon trade, the soldiers' identities hidden for their safety.
Here in government-controlled Aleppo, we hope to find further evidence of the regime's role. We had to film secretly. This is the rarely seen interior of an army barracks. It's in a strikingly dilapidated state. We find a soldier willing to speak to us if we hide his identity. He tells us his monthly pay is only about 150,000 Syrian lira.
150,000 lira is equivalent to about $25 or $30. Barely enough for someone supporting two or three kids. So we became dealers selling to people. It's what brings in most of the money now.
We ask him to describe his unit's role in the local Captagon trade.
In 2021, I went out in a convoy with my comrades. We weren't allowed to go to the factory. They'd pick a meeting place and we'd buy from Hezbollah. The bags would contain 1 or 4 or 5 kilos. They'd decide how to fill them. We'd receive the goods, cover them, and leave. We coordinated with the 4th Division. The leaders would coordinate. The 4th Division's task was to facilitate our movement. If there was a traffic jam, they'd clear it, stop the traffic so our convoy could move.
Once again, the Syrian army's elite 4th Division is named. Sutu is Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia political party and militant group. They're close to the Syrian government and have themselves been accused of involvement in drug trafficking.
The primary people responsible for manufacturing Captagon pills are Bashar al-Assad and his brother Maher al-Assad in association with Lebanese Hezbollah. The money goes straight into their pockets.
That's a clip from the new BBC documentary Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire. For more, we're joined by Rasha Kandil. Welcome to Democracy Now! This is a powerful documentary. Captagon may be a new word for people outside of the region. It's been described as the poor man's cocaine. Can you tell us about it and how it came to be so prevalent, the production in Syria, but then especially its use in Saudi Arabia?
Thank you very much for having me. This is a sophisticated project by the BBC Arabic News Investigations team and the OCCRP. Being the lead reporter of the BBC team on this, we've been following in six countries for a year and a half the network, the web. We've been building this using witnesses, using unseen evidence, WhatsApp conversations, inside testimonies, a lot of leads. So it is called that because it's actually not very new, but it's new as a substance in the Middle East. Originally, it's an amphetamine-like substance, and it has been developed by Germany in the First and Second World War. But the formula being used now is very, very different. So it only carries the trade name of Captagon. We've come to the conclusion after a year and a half of work in six countries, France, Germany, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and the United Kingdom, there are direct links between members of the 4th Division and members of the Assad's family to the trade in the region, which is, as you probably know more than I am, it's flagged. Very important project in terms of the capacity of CRP.
We're talking to Rasha Kandil. She is a presenter with BBC Arabic, talking about this drug, Captagon. If you can explain, Rasha, how it's determining the geopolitics of the region and the acceptance of the Bashar al-Assad regime, inviting them back into the Arab community and possibly leading to the lifting of sanctions.
Thank you very much for the excellent question. It's actually a force of pressure, not only in the region, but also on an international level. And as for the EU and the United States are concerned, that clearly shows, and this is what I indicated, and my team, the brilliant director and all the rest of the team, indicate that the sanctions on the Syrian and Lebanese people is not actually the impact that was targeted by the United States and recently by the United Kingdom. It is a force in the region, in the Middle East, and as you know, there is a new renormalization with Bashar al-Assad in Arab League recently. And from insider information from the Arab League, I've heard many times throughout filming this investigation that it was actually the main card on the table. And I've been told by prominent sources that Bashar al-Assad was asked directly to control the Captagon in the region in return of Syria coming back to the Arab League. So definitely in the coming few months, this is going to be a main factor in a lot of changes in the Middle East, probably in the dynamics as well between Russia and the United States, given the heat happening in Ukraine. And also the trade itself is very, very powerful. The networks are universal now. And the alternative routes that are developed by smugglers every single day are reaching out fast and furious to Europe. And nobody knows yet if it's reaching the United States or not, but nothing is impossible in such trade. Five pills are being produced every year and consumed by the Gulf. You've pointed to a very important thing, which is why Saudi Arabia is the biggest consumer in this. I've also heard, even though that we haven't really had much interaction with Saudi Arabia, they were not very involved in the film. But I've heard from prominent sources in the Gulf that they consider this to be a war by Bashar al-Assad on them as a return back to the war on Syria since 2012. So it's definitely a geopolitical issue that needs to be looked into.
And Arasha, just before we end, if you could tell us who are the principal consumers, who are the people who are addicted to Captagon in Syria, but also in Saudi Arabia and other places?
I've heard horrific stories over a year and a half about young people, minors under 15, who consume this heavily in all the countries that I've visited, in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria, and at the Gulf. And I've heard other stories from prominent officials in the Middle East that some of them are being abused to be used as smugglers. So they are forced to become addicts, and then they are used on the borders to become smugglers because they cost almost nothing in return to the profit that goes back to those who are making use of this trade. So I'm really sorry to say that it's mostly young people. Some of them are targeted on purpose. But also there are, like, we've interviewed in the film a user, and he's under 22 years of old, and he's been an addict for 6 years. The atrocities he's been subjected to and told us are untold. It's really sad to see a new generation relying on such substance and just not being able to get out of it.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're having trouble with the Skype connection. Rasha Kandil, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Senior Fellow, Center for International Policy, presenter for BBC Arabic. You can see the new documentary, Captagon, Inside Syria's Drug Trafficking Empire, on YouTube. And Dr. Zahar Salul, President and CEO of Med Global. Back in 30 seconds with Congressmember Ro Khanna. Stay with us. Return by Aruj Aftab. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we spend the rest of the hour with Democratic Congressmember Ro Khanna, who has several topics to discuss with us. Congressmember, thanks so much for being with us. Joining us, though, you represent California from Charleston, South Carolina. We want to start with your introduction of a bill to limit Supreme Court justices to 18-year terms. What are you calling for?
Amy, most Americans have seen that the Supreme Court is just wildly out of touch with the facts of modern life. They're taking away rights from women. They are penalizing students who are poorer. They are making campuses less diverse. They're rolling back environmental legislation. So what we are saying is, let's have term limits on these justices. Every president gets two appointments. The justices get 18 years, and then they can go serve on a lower court. So they remain a judge for life under the Constitution.
And what about the number of Supreme Court justices one president can choose? I've heard the number two. You know, Trump chose three, of course.
Exactly. Every president would get two appointments. And so this would prevent something like the Merrick Garland situation, which has cast such illegitimacy on the court, where Mitch McConnell just blocked President Obama from picking someone and then expedited the process for Trump to get three appointments. Now every president would get an appointment, two appointments in their four-year term.
And Congressmember, can you also talk about being the sole person, I think it was 58-1, on the House Armed Services Committee to vote no on the new Pentagon budget?
Well, Amy, it's not a distinction that I want. I wish more of my colleagues would recognize what is so obvious to many Americans, that you have a bloated Pentagon budget. Defense contractors are making extraordinary profits, having goods sold to the American public at 10,000% inflation. And we need to tackle that. So the money is not just going to troops. It's not just going to national security. It's lining the pockets of many of these defense executives. And we're approaching almost a $1 trillion defense budget. It's nearly 56% of discretionary income. I rather that we be investing some of that money in our schools here at home, in creating good jobs here at home, in helping the working class.
I also wanted to ask you about the visit of Prime Minister Modi. President Biden welcomed the Indian Prime Minister to the White House, praising a new era in U.S.-India relations, the trip roundly condemned by human rights advocates. At least five Democratic lawmakers announced plans to boycott Modi's joint address to Congress, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman. In a post on social media, Congressmember Tlaib wrote, "It's shameful that Modi's been given a platform at our nation's capital. His long history of human rights abuses, anti-democratic actions targeting Muslims and religious minorities, and censoring journalists is unacceptable," she said. More than 70 Democrats in the House and Senate also signed a letter urging Biden to focus on human rights in talks with Modi. Congressmember Khanna, many in the progressive community were surprised to learn you were not only in favor of Modi addressing a joint session of Congress and Biden welcoming Modi with a rare state dinner, one of the highest diplomatic honors bestowed on a foreign leader, but you were a major engine for this. Amit Srivastava wrote in Truthout, "Why did Rep. Khanna, who positions himself as a progressive, choose to invite Modi in spite of the prime minister and the BJP's track record of violence and bigotry, especially at a moment when the Uttarakhand and Manipur violence are escalating? The answer lies in the U.S.-India defense partnership and the drive toward war. It's clear that in the context of a growing Cold War with China and Russia, the West has decided it's time to withdraw India in, even if it means playing to the megalomania of an authoritarian leader." Your response, Congressmember Khanna?
Well, it's a fair question. I believe that the prime minister is an elected leader of 1.4 billion people. And the way to make progress on human rights is to engage with the Indian prime minister. I also am sensitive that India is two generations removed from colonialism. My grandfather, as you know, spent years in jail under British colonialism and then was part of the Congress Party advocating for pluralism. So the idea that India is going to respond simply by being lectured from the West is not going to work. And my view is similar to Fareed Zakaria's or President Obama's, that we have to engage India, a rising democracy, an ally, though they have problems, and then have a conversation about the challenge of multiracial, multiethnic democracy. And that means respecting minority rights. It means making sure that Sikhs, Muslims, Christians, all are treated equally and having those candid conversations with the prime minister and others, as I did when I had the opportunity to meet the prime minister. But to simply boycott a country that has chosen to elect their own leader, I think, would be a mistake and not actually advance human rights in India.
According to The Nation, you received more than $110,000 from Hindu nationalist figures in the United States. Your response?
Well, we raise millions of dollars online. There are many Indian Americans who contribute to our campaign, many Pakistani Americans who contribute to our campaign. I don't ask their view on Indian politics when they're contributing, but certainly I have gone out of my way to criticize right-wing nationalism in India, to stand up for pluralism, and even have, in the last two election cycles, had a challenger who has been supported by some of the extreme elements because they didn't like my stance on pluralism.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Congressmember Ro Khanna, Democratic Congressmember from California, Deputy Whip of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, just recently voted no on the Pentagon budget, the sole voice in the Armed Service Committee. The vote was 58-1, that vote from Ro Khanna. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, and Sanji Lopez, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagara, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see our interviews and video and audio podcasts, you can go to democracynow.org and sign up there for a daily news digest. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
Well, hello there, everybody, and welcome to episode number 2326 of Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio, or The Roots Program, depending on where you are listening. I am Mando Richard, and I've got a pretty darn good show for you today. Yeah, we'll start off on the liquored up side of the family, like we usually do. We'll close down on the gospel side of the family, like we usually do. And along the way, we'll hear lots of great music, including five tracks picked out by WVUD's own Woody Snyder. Well, what say we get started with Wayne the Train Hancock, eh?
Sitting in a juke joint, surrounded by alcohol. Sitting in a juke joint, surrounded by alcohol. Well, if I'm gonna have me one beer, you know I'm gonna drink 'em all. Temptation, temptation, why you won't mess with me? Yeah. Temptation, temptation, why you won't mess with me? 'Cause you're all about nothing, hard times and misery. Come in, John. did jail down in Atlanta. Friday evening, locked up in the county jail. Well, I had to call my good gal, 'cause no one's gonna throw my bail. Come in, Mr. Rivers.